Good afternoon, I am Wiley Main, my registration number is 26.
Mr. Main, if I can ask you, and can we stop the clock for one second? I intended to ask before, in terms of dividing time, are you all just going to share your 15 minutes?
We are.
Okay, just wanted to make sure, I apologize.
No problem, thank you. And apropos of that, I do intend to discuss plaintiff's standing, timeliness, the Rule 106 issue with respect to any claim that arises from these events, and certain private aspects of the deed restriction. I understand Mr. Smith will address why the deed restriction is not contrary to the Colorado statute at issue, and why, even if it were, Mr. Meyerstein is estopped. Let me turn then to plaintiff's standing. The test, as we all agree, is standing requires injury in fact to a legally protected interest. Here, there is no injury, in fact, to Mr. Meyerstein. Mr. Meyerstein took with knowledge of the deed restriction. The record is clear, not only that he had knowledge, but that he negotiated a price for this property that was some $2 million less than it would have been had the deed restriction not been in place. So Mr. Meyerstein now has exactly what he bargained for. Going back to my property class, he has that same bundle of sticks that he acquired from his grantor. No sticks have been taken away from him.
As I understand, Mr. Main, Mr. Meyerstein's argument is that while his predecessor in interest may have purchased the property for a reduced price, that today Mr. Meyerstein can't rent the units for as much as he would otherwise be able to if the restrictions weren't in place, and therefore that's causing him injury in fact right now.
That is his argument, and I would suggest that's not a correct argument. That argument could be made by any owner who has a property that's got some sort of recorded burden on it. But it's clear from the case law that you take subject to the burdens that are of record of your property, on your property. It's not an injury under the law that you can't do something which the law, which the chain of title precludes you from doing. So, for example, if there were an easement on the property, you couldn't claim that you were injured by that easement, which was of record. And another way to look at that, Your Honor, is that Mr. Meyerstein never owned a right to charge higher rents. So he hasn't lost that right.
Well, listen, I guess, excuse me, Mr. Main, and I'm trying to follow this. I mean, he's claiming, of course, that the restriction was void ab initio, should never have been there, so he's lost that right. And I recognize that your side has arguments that he shouldn't be able to do that. But, I mean, really getting back to what Judge Talman asked, you know, why can't he at least assert, I have a tangible interest here, this restriction was void ab initio, I am hurt at least on a going forward basis. And I guess my question or concern is whether or not conflating the question of damages versus the question of injury in fact. I mean, I think they're two different things. And your argument has some persuasive force to me in terms of a damages analysis, but I'm not so sure in terms of an injury in fact analysis. So could you address that? Why can't he argue that he's injured in fact from his premise, that this is void ab initio, I'm hurt on a going forward basis? I mean, why doesn't that get him there?
My answer to that is I believe the same, and that is that if you took with knowledge of the burden, then the existence of the burden is not an injury to you. And that's, you know, basic Colorado property law. It's the law of all states. If it's there in the chain of title, you accepted that burden when you took the property. That might be a useful segue to talk about the takings cases. We just heard Mr. Cote concede that in the other case, there was a taking. Well, here it's clear that in the takings cases, the subsequent purchaser has no standing to complain about a taking that occurred during the tenure of his predecessor. The district court to dismiss the taken cases, but with no explanation. Mr. Meyerstein has provided to this court no explanation as to why the takings cases aren't the dispositive precedent. And we submit that they are. That under their theory, we don't agree with their theory, but under their theory, there was a taking when the city imposed, allegedly imposed, a deed restriction on this property.
I can ask another question on this one, Mr. Main, relating to standing, and I guess it goes to whether we have to, the issue you're raising is complex and I think somewhat difficult, but I'm wondering whether we even have to get there. As I read the notice of violation in this case, it was pretty limited. Yes, you didn't qualify tenants, and you didn't give us leases. And I guess I have a question as to whether the rent, and this will go to the argument about Starwood standing as well, is this issue of rent control even before us in this case? Why does anyone have, where is the case or controversy relating to rent control in this case, when the notice of violation doesn't seem, arguably doesn't go to that? Did my question make sense? Or
I understand your question. I really can't respond to it, I'm afraid. I mean, I think that's not the invocation of by the city of the demand is not the triggering event. That's not what gives right to a claim for relief in this case, if anything. The claim for relief, if there is one, is what Mr. Meyerstein is focused on, which is the original allegedly improper imposition of rent control through the deed restriction on this property. That's probably not a very good answer to your question, that's a question I didn't anticipate. I want to talk real briefly about the racial covenant, because I think that's equally a question in this case. Why isn't that dispositive of the standing issue, or why isn't that a useful analogy? If we're talking about the same case when we talk about the Shelley case, if we're talking about the 1940s U.S. Supreme Court opinion, interestingly, that's not a standing case. That was an enforcement case. That was a case in which someone came in and said, I want to enforce this covenant. And the Supreme Court said, no, the courts cannot. If the court enforced your covenant, that would be unconstitutional state action. So it wasn't a question about standing. Here, even if there were a racial covenant, it would be unenforceable under that opinion. It would be void under federal legislation. It would be void under Colorado legislation. So I would submit that there is no injury from having a racial covenant on your property today. And interestingly, Colorado has a statute, 3830-169, about removing racial covenants, and it doesn't grant the owner the right to do that. A lawyer, a title company may do it, but not the owner. So I would suggest that shouldn't trouble us as an analogy. Let me turn quickly to the 106 issue and go directly to a question that was raised in the last issue. Here, Mr. Meyerstein not only wasn't around at the time of this allegedly illegal imposition, he was 12 years away from getting involved. But I think the point is not, did he have notice? The point is, was this an effective remedy? Is this the type of action which Rule 106 was intended to address? And I think the answer to that is yes. And maybe another way to look at that would be helpful is to say, in any case in which Rule 106 is the correct remedy, a purchaser who acquires the property more than 30 days after the event is somebody who likely wouldn't have had notice of the event, but still is barred because 106 was the remedy.
Mr. Main, this question may best be addressed to Mr. Smith, and feel free to pass it off to him. Based on your argument, how then do you distinguish the DCPA case and the Norby case, which basically says if the person didn't have notice and an opportunity to participate, Rule 57 is an appropriate means to pursue the claim?
Well, Rule 57 is an appropriate means to pursue the claim, but it's clear from the case law that you have to do that within 30 days, too. That if it's a Rule 106 kind of case, you may couple your 106 claim with a Rule 57 claim, but you have to do it within the 30 days.
that?
I think at this point, unless you have questions about the private agreement aspects, I better, I better yield the rest of the time to Mr. Smith. Thank you so much.
Smith, you've got a little over 5 minutes.
Tom Smith for the Assapika County Housing Authority, 6463. I'd like to start briefly with the last question, but I want to spend a little time on this public policy question. But I guess the court has to decide if, is the door open every time a property changes hands? I mean, that's a key consideration here, because it should be pretty obvious that conveying property for the purpose of establishing legal claims is a pretty simple thing to do. You can transfer it from corporation to corporation, or an interfamily transfer, or any other kind of conveyance. It should be clear that the point of Rule 106 is that when the 30-day period runs, that's it. And that a challenge to a quasi-judicial decision does not run with the land and go to the benefit of a new purchaser or open the door just because the property is conveyed to somebody else.
So even if it's an illegal provision from the get-go, no one else, after 30 days, no one ever has a chance to challenge it.
Well, let's talk about that. Are we talking about a provision that was illegal?
I would like you to answer my question. Assume it was. If it's illegal, mustn't you have a right to challenge it after 30 days?
I think that you still have a question of jurisdiction, and that you don't get to the merits of whether it's illegal or not unless there is jurisdiction and unless the plaintiff has standing. And in this case, he does not. It's hard to argue the point regarding racial discrimination, but that's not our case. We're dealing with a case of economic regulation, and different considerations apply.
Mr. Smith, if Mr. Meyerstein had wanted to challenge the Aspen ordinances on their face based on the Telluride case, could he have done so through a declaratory judgment action, or is your view that he could not have done so under, whether it's under Rule 57 or Rule 106?
In this case, that's exactly what he's done. He's brought a facial challenge to the city ordinances, and the trial court, in our view, erroneously struck down those ordinances. And our view on the jurisdictional question is that, as Mr. Main has stated, is that you're obligated to bring your Rule 106 and declaratory judgment claims in a single action within the 30-day period, and the developer didn't do that, and Meyerstein is barred from doing that. In addition, there is a, so to the extent that he's challenging the legislation, we've briefed at length the fact that Mr. Meyerstein is not affected by the legislation. He wasn't a developer. He didn't submit an application. He brought a property subject to a deed restriction. Well, if and only if that deed restriction is invalidated, does Mr. Meyerstein benefit. Invalidating the legislation does him no good. And let me turn briefly to this public policy question, because the public policy question here under the rent control statute is not black and white, as Mr. Cote would have the court believe. Number one, there's an exception in the statute for property in which a property owner has an interest, and the housing authority has that interest in this case. Number two, there is the new exception in House Bill 1017 for voluntary agreements. That's part of the public policy of the state too now, that those exceptions are both in there.
But the court found as a matter of law, in this case, it was involuntary. There's a finding in this case directly.
It did decide that, in this case, yes, the court found involuntary, but I would say that the criteria I talked about with respect to the last case were not addressed at all by the court. Whether or not there are objective manifestations of mutual assent in the record, court didn't address it. Whether or not there was duress, fraud, or incapacity, court didn't address it. Those are the legal criteria for determining voluntariness, not whether the developer wants to do it. That's not the way you look at this issue. So, in addition, considering public policy, there are two recent cases we've cited in our briefs, Mason v. Orthodontic Centers out of the Federal District Court of Colorado in 2007, which cites FDIC versus American Casualty Company out of the Colorado Supreme Court in 1992. And therein, the court identifies various considerations that go into effect and have to be evaluated to determine if a public policy against something identified by a statute is may not be outweighed by other factors. And I would encourage the court, since I'm out of time, to look at that part of our brief, because we think there are countervailing factors that should be considered that do come into play in the Telluride case, because that was a facial challenge, and this is not a facial challenge. It's an as-applied challenge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel.
This time I'll remember to tell you that my registration number is 18194. So
thank you.
Got that. Yeah, the there's an argument that I want to raise here on this, the idea that the deed restriction itself is the interest in the property contemplated by the statute. In our case, I think the judge rightly analyzed that, in saying you have already know what she said. I think now there's this new amendment to the statute that may be retroactively applied in our case, and that contains something I think that speaks to this issue. Is if you look at 2B, if I can find it, let me right in here. I think that this 2B says, you know, what it is doing is saying these things won't be illegal if, and A is if it's voluntary, and B is the placement on the deed restriction, or the placing on the unit of a deed restriction that limits rent on the property or unit, or that is otherwise designed to provide affordable housing stock. Now, I think that the idea that you have an interest is no longer, it's now been carved out. It has to be a voluntary agreement, or it has to be something pursuant to a voluntary agreement. Now,
Mr. Cote, what about the language about having an interest in the property? Has that been eliminated, or is that still in the statute?
Well, it's in this. I thought it was still in the statute under this.
Well, that was my understanding as well. So, I mean, if it's still in the statute, then isn't that a factor that we would need to consider in addition to the voluntariness question?
Well, and I think that under the old statute, well, it wasn't under the old statute, but with this new language, what you have to consider is, was this interest part of a voluntary agreement? So I guess what my argument is now, voluntariness wasn't a part of the old statute. Now, as a part of the new statute, it sort of subsumes the argument about an interest, because if you have a voluntary agreement that includes a deed restriction interest, it's enforceable. But if you don't have a voluntary agreement, the fact that it's a deed restriction interest, I don't think gets you there anymore, right? And I think that's what 2B speaks to, is that it has to be pursuant to a voluntary agreement. Just the imposition of the interest directly doesn't do it, if I'm reading it right. And I know this is brand new, I could be very wrong, but that's my reading of it. Is that now this is being limited to, it has to be part of a voluntary agreement, thereby making that if we decide that a deed restriction is imposed pursuant to a local ordinance not voluntary, if we decide that it was not voluntary, then the fact that it was imposed at all doesn't then pull you back in to some other standard. You're gone, right?
I'm wondering whether, Mr. Cote, whether we even have to go there. And the trial court, in this case, without having the benefit of the amended statute, rejected this argument about an interest. And as best as I understood her argument, I think she's basically saying, you can't use that exception as an end run around the statute. By way of example here, and correct me if my understanding is wrong, if interest could be read so broadly that you know, essentially a governmental entity could say, I want to be a party to every document containing a deed restriction, they've now emasculated the statute. I mean, I think that's what the trial judge was getting at. Am I reading that right?
That is exactly how I read the order.
And would that change, and I agree with Judge Talmadge, it's still in the statute, and I don't think we could ignore it,
right.
But I think the argument is the same today as it was before the new statute.
And I agree. I'm just trying to say that, well, maybe there's a reading here of this 2B that would make this no longer even an issue. That either it is or it isn't, right? It's not.
Okay.
It's not, because if it's not, and again, maybe it's tautological. But it's saying if it has to be voluntary, you know, then that would exclude deed restrictions that aren't voluntary. Again, forcing us to do the voluntary analysis, right? And so I guess what I'm really arguing is that this whole interest thing is no longer an issue, where voluntariness is a threshold issue.
If I can ask you the same question, I think I caught Mr. Maine unwittingly by surprise, and I didn't mean to. Could you address the question of case or controversy in this case? The notice of violation was pretty limited to me. I didn't see anything in the record to suggest that anyone right now was enforcing, any one way or the other, to saying you're being forced to charge below market rates in your client at this point. I guess I'm puzzled or questioning, where is the controversy in this case relating to the rent control provision? I know you've alleged it in the complaint, but you know, where's Mr. Meyerstein hurt so far?
Well, under Rule 57, as a person that's subject to a deed restriction on our property, you know, we have the right to seek court review. So I would say that as to the issue on rent control, apart from the notice of violations, which we believe a trial would show that, you know, the reason that they're saying that you have to prove these tenants is because they think we're charging too much, but regardless of that, you know, we, under Rule 57, would have that right as a person who's subject to a deed restriction.
But there still has to be a controversy. And the distinction I'll make, in the prior case, in the other case, on the record, there was a discussion about, you know, this issue about charging higher rent or not. And at the administrative hearing, everyone says, well, I'm not prepared to deal with that. And maybe it's Mr. Smith said, me either, and y'all moved on. But at least there was on the face of that record, there was an arguable threat that they were intending to pursue that. Here, I didn't see anything in the record, but maybe there is. I mean, there has to be a controversy even under Rule 57.
Right.
So I accept that we're not limited at the notice of violation, but where is the actual controversy about your right to charge or not charge rent? Where is there a threat in the record that they're going to enforce it?
Well, we have a situation where we have rented to people. They have said, we get to approve that, and we get to approve those people, and we get to approve those leases. This is all part of the scheme of rent control identified in the Telluride case. It is not limited to, and I think the trial judge in this case made a mistake when she said, it's only limited, I'm going to cross out the provisions, right, that are only limited to rent control, and the others I'm not going to touch. I think that's a mistake. But because it is a scheme of rent control, it is a part and parcel. So when we get a notice of violation that says we get to approve who you put in there, we get to approve your lease, that is part of the scheme of rent control. And so I believe that gives us the case of controversy that you're talking about. So I refer you to the Telluride case when it discusses the entire scheme, as opposed to just the one sentence that says rent control is a cap on rents. I mean, okay, yes, thanks. But it's also the case goes on to analyze the effect of the entire scheme and what it does to the statewide concerns, I think was the area that they were discussing it in, is that's why the statewide concerns dominate over the local concerns. But the, okay, that's case or controversy. As I say, on the constitutional claims, on the 1983 claim and the takings claim, then I think we've also alleged a case or controversy there on both of those claims. So and I think that's kind of set out in the briefs on what we say the case of controversy is there. And again, it goes to, you know, when the city says, you know, you have to rent to this person or you can't rent to that person, we have an interference with our Fifth Amendment rights to rent our property or not rent our property to who we want. So we've alleged a constitutional injury in spite of, in one of the two cases, that they said there wasn't a constitutional injury, maybe both of them. And so the thing is I want to point out is that our Fifth Amendment right is the constitutional injury that we're alleging here. We're not alleging the, you know, it keeps getting characterized as an economic case. And, you know, the transaction costs of this economic case, you know, way outweigh, you know, whatever these things are going to rent for. So you can't really, that kind of goes to the windfall argument. Everybody's assumed, oh, it's a windfall because he's going to get to raise his rental rates. But in reality, the transaction costs overwhelm whatever this rental rate increase is. You know, the fact of the matter is that constitutional rights are being interfered with by the city in this case. And the Supreme Court has recognized that it's something that they shouldn't be doing. And so now to keep focusing on, well, did the developer agree to this, is kind of ridiculous when the ordinance under which this all happened says you have to do it. If you don't do it, you're deemed denied. So, you know, now we're going to go look at duress or we're going to go look at some other contract kind of thing. Again, I get back to that. It's like this is something that is dictated by statute in violation of a state public policy. Now there was an issue on the statute of limitations in the constitutional claims as well. I want to say that you've got, I think both judges said that these 1983 claims weren't torts, and that then they somehow then said, okay, so we don't have to apply the continuing tort analysis. There's a Supreme Court case, Monterey versus Del Monte Monterey Dunes, 526 U.S. 687, 1999, which identifies these kinds of claims as torts. So I think you do have to go back and apply the continuing tort doctrine, the continuing trespass doctrine. In fact, I mean, what we're having in the MAA case, it is an actual physical trespass. You have to take the MAA, you have to rent to them. You have to throw out any tenant you have to rent to them. That is a physical taking. Okay, and that physical taking occurred not sometime in the past before we showed up. We bought this property. It said May, right? It says the May rent. Right? It doesn't say, there's no mandate in the deed restriction. And it speaks in the other document to a priority, right? Which is more, sounds more like a first right of refusal than a you must do this. Now, all of a sudden, in 2008, we get a notice and a determination that you must in 106. You know, now we're in 106 on that, but yes, you must. That is a proper determination. But, you know, but even if that was a proper determination, that is new.
How do you deal with the cases, Mr. Main alluded to them, and I know Mr. Smith cites them in his brief, on the takings in particular? There are innumerable cases that say the taking happens, you know, to the original owner in this case.
When it's void, it doesn't. Okay? I think we've cited those cases. When it's void, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's of no first effect. When it's a continuing tort, it doesn't. And in fact, if I could just real quick here, there's a great point. You know, the Horry case talks about, and I forget the name of the other case, where they put in a ditch and it was in the right spot, but it leaked. And they said, well, you know what? We're not, even though that is a continuing tort, we're not going to apply the continuing tort contract because that is a socially beneficial structure. Right? We have exactly the opposite here. Right. We have something that has been determined not to be socially beneficial, and in fact to be against public policy. And so isn't that a reason to apply the continuing tort doctrine? right? If in the one case you were going to say, well, we're not going to apply it in a socially beneficial situation, well, shouldn't the reverse be true, that we're going to apply it when it's not, when it is, in fact, I've confused myself, but in the instance where you don't have that socially beneficial thing, and in fact you have a negative social benefit that you should apply. And if I could just real quick say that the last one is the continuing trespass doctrine should also be an answer to your question, is that especially where you are saying you have to rent to someone that we approve, and we think that our trial judge in the Ute case didn't make a mistake by interlineating the deed restriction and saying that you could only do these things, because again, it's the whole scheme of rent control that we have to address. Thank you. This is great.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Coates. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank all counsel for your briefs and arguments. I know we all put a lot of work and time into this, and we very much appreciate it. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel in this case are excused.